This is Line One, your health connection, a weekly program produced at the studios of KSKA. Each week, KSKA's host, Dr. Thad Woodard, puts you in touch with local and national experts in a variety of health and family issues. Opinions expressed are those of the host, guest, and callers, and do not represent those of KSKA, the licensee, or the underwriters. Here's your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
Good morning. Good afternoon, I guess it is. Welcome once again to Line One, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Kevin Tamara. We're going to be talking about urinary incontinence and kidney stones and maybe a few other urological issues. But before we get into this, I want to make a comment or two. One, there's a tendency in this country because of the way we've been incented, that is what we get reimbursed for or what we get rewarded for doing, to believe that expensive and high-tech medical care is the best care. Now, you got to stop and think about that for a second because that's not necessarily true. And so I found something that caught my eye because it's not expensive and it's not high-tech, and maybe it's going to pan out to be a pretty good treatment for one of the problems in my area, and that's child care and pediatrics. And it has to do with a study where they've been looking at the importance of exercise in grade school. And it's caught on particularly in North Carolina, where they stop the classroom, they do exercise, stop the classes frequently and do some exercise. They do a little bit of exercise during activities where they're reading and so forth. And what they're finding is that kids seem to be doing better when they do that. And it's not that it's going to make people smarter, people say. It's just that it activates the brain a little bit better and makes them their brain seem to work a little bit more efficiently. But what really caught my attention is when you look at kids with attention deficit disorder and what has happened to them as they add a little exercise to the classroom each day. And you got to remember now, we only started putting kids and into classrooms probably in a big way in the last 100, 150 years of our evolution. Big change, and some of us probably are not so well adapted to sitting in a classroom all day without doing much. So it turns out if you take kids that have attentional deficit disorder and are off task 50% of the time or less than 50% of the time, and you do just a little exercise every day, you increase their attention and off task their attention ability up to about 70% with just doing a little bit of exercise. So not very expensive, not very high tech. Of course, that needs to be re-verified in a couple of ways, but it seems to be panning off for some researchers at the Eastern Carolina University in some of their studies and in North Carolina, where it seems like about 85% in the report I read of school districts are now using some sort of exercise program in the classroom in that state. Kevin, welcome to Line One.
Well, thank you.
Why do we need to talk about incontinence?
Because it's a very common problem. People don't talk about it, but if you go to Costco, they have a whole section of diapers.
And what do you mean by incontinence? Let's define our term.
We're talking about urinary incontinence, mm-hmm. And urinary incontinence is the uncontrolled leakage of urine. Mm-hmm.
Primarily, I'm assuming in older individuals is where this is an issue, or is that not true?
It can happen in different age groups, mm-hmm. and there's different types of incontinence. Okay. There's the incontinence, for example, urge incontinence. Urge incontinence is where you know you have to go, but you can't hold it until you make it to the bathroom. There's, of course, stress incontinence, which occurs predominantly in females, where if they lift something, they cough, they do jogging, and they'll leak some urine every time they cough and sneeze. Usually occurs, unfortunately, as a result of several vaginal deliveries, but occurs in about 60% of females who've had hysterectomies. Then there's mixed, which is a pattern of both, okay?
Okay. Well, let's – before we get – I always like to define things a little bit, and you were giving me a little bit of a hard time about this, but let's talk about how we control bladder function and relate it to age also. You know, kids are different than adults, but how do we control the sensation of feeling like we have to go urinate, and how do we control and keep that from happening, and then how do we let it happen? And then what's gone wrong when we have incontinence? And you've defined several different kinds of incontinence.
Sure. But we can talk about, you know, basically the two extremes of our age, below age 2, We don't know that our bladder feels full, and so when the bladder has any urine at all, when it stretches the bladder past a certain point, you just go ahead and urinate. At the same time, at the other extreme of age, as we get forgetful or Alzheimer's or get demented, similarly, the brain no longer is cognitive. And so, unfortunately, those people will end up with incontinence, not because the spinal cord or the bladder has become abnormal, but unfortunately because the cerebellum and the cerebrum has had atrophy and other changes with Alzheimer's. So about age 2, we become potty trained. And that sometimes is part of the problem, because if you force kids too hard, you can have abnormal voiding and place too much emphasis, because every kid is a little bit different. Bedwetting can be a problem, which is not always the kid's fault. It's a lack of development. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, once we develop normal adult patterns of voiding, in other words, we're able to choose when we go to the bathroom, it turns out that the next problem comes up with a sense of urgency. A lot of people will feel that, or they're the cute commercials on TV where you got to go right now, and they're always pushing pills. And then, of course, the other problem that happens, particularly in females, is unfortunately I call it the bowling balls. You know, the vaginal deliveries, the big heads come through and kind of stretch things out. And as we age, the elasticity of the tissue and the pelvic floor support and our lack of our sedentary behavior exacerbates that. Surgery exacerbates that with hysterectomy, with lack of pelvic support. So then we start ending up with, in females, stress urinary incontinence, the incontinence that occurs when they cough, sneeze, and leak.
All right. Let me remind our listeners how to get in touch with us. You're listening to Line 1. Our topics today are urinary incontinence and kidney stones. In particular, my guest is Dr. Kevin Tamara, a urologist here in Anchorage. If you've got questions or comments on what you hear, here are some phone numbers and a way to get in touch with us by email. The local telephone number, 550-8433. 550-8433. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and you can email us during the program from 2 to 3 today at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org. Remember, we repeat each Monday evening at 8 o'clock, so if you are hearing us at that time, we're not taking any messages or phone calls. Let's get some more basics. Tell me the anatomy of the urinary tract system, how it starts, why it functions, and how the urine gets formed, and then how do we control it a little bit more sophisticatedly?
Sure. At any given moment, 20% of your blood is flowing through your kidneys, and it turns out our kidneys are getting rid of a lot of waste byproducts. Some of it, water is not really a byproduct, but we need some of that to filter our through our kidneys. And the reason why we, for example, can't live on salt water is that there's a limit to how well humans can concentrate their urine. Having said that, it turns out that almost never is kidney dysfunction a cause of urinary incontinence. Okay?
Right.
Sometimes you can aggravate urinary problems, for example, in diabetics because of the load of urine, but it's not the primary cause of why people leak urine. So the urine then comes down our tubes, and we have these little flap valves in the bladder. And then what the function of the flap valves are is so that when our bladder gets full and when we void, the urine doesn't back up to our kidneys. We can actually make urine in space, and we can make urine standing on our head because our plumbing has got living tubes. We have peristalsis, and the muscles contract. And all this is done involuntarily. We have absolutely no – people don't know when their ureters are pumping urine into the bladder.
Mm-hmm.
The bladder itself is just a storage organ. It just stretches. It's actually remarkable skin. Normal human skin can stretch about a third before it cracks and splits. But your bladder goes from 50 milliliters in size to 700 milliliters in size. The skin, the urothelium will stretch 13 times. And so it's a very remarkable, unique sort of skin. And it actually has proprioception, a sense of pressure or tension. It also has thermoreceptors, and it can feel – actually, inside of your bladder can feel cold water or hot water. And it turns out that what happens when the bladder starts to stretch, we send off afferent signals when we get about 4 ounces of urine in there. And normally, Your brain sends down an inhibitory signal down to the distal spinal cord telling it not now. Mm-hmm. It tells you to hold it. And then what happens is when the bladder gets close to the capacity of the bladder, anywhere from 400 milliliters, which is a can of pop is 355 milliliters, so that gives you 12 ounces of urine, to, of course, some guys can hold almost 2 liters, a six-pack of beer. It turns out that when it gets close to the capacity of the bladder, then all of a sudden the pressure becomes unendurable and you have to go. Mm-hmm. The problem comes up with is something goes wrong with the feedback loop. And when something goes wrong with the feedback loop, we mistake small volumes for being at physical capacity where it's not. And so we no longer can choose when to mark the territory. All of a sudden our bladder is telling us that we need to find out where every bathroom is in town. The urethra, we have a valve that helps close, and we don't even think about keep closing that valve. The act of voiding is an act of relaxation, and that's easy enough to prove. When somebody walks in on almost everybody when we're in the act of voiding, we sort of slow down. We clam up. Mm-hmm. And so what actually happens is the external sphincter or distal sphincter has to relax before the bladder contracts, and then the urine comes out. The what can happen, unfortunately, particularly in females, is that the act of childbirth or hysterectomy, you lose some of the pelvic floor support, and when you have a big cough, the bladder comes down, and it's kind of like having a weak spring on a car. Now all of a sudden the car hits the ground. And so the correction for stress urinary incontinence is either some pelvic floor exercises called Kegel, after Dr. Kegel, or another thing is a minimal outpatient procedure now where we put a sling of nylon mesh so that the car or the bladder no longer bottoms out and opens up the urethra.
In nocturnal bedwet, we have a caller. It looks like, I'm not sure they're still on the line, but the issue has to do with bedwetting and tonsils removed, and that gets us back into childhood a little bit. The control of urine during the evening, maybe we should talk about that a little bit before we get into this issue of bedwetting and tonsils.
Actually, I like that because it might be actually may have been sleep apnea. Mm-hmm. It actually turns out that sometimes when somebody's brought to you, particularly if it wasn't primary enuresis, if all of a sudden they have developed it, the reason why they're bedwetting has nothing to do with the bladder or lack of development. It has to do, it's a sign of the apnea that occurs during sleep. And mm-hmm. we always think of old people having sleep apnea, but kids can get sleep apnea from those big tonsils.
I also think of myself, and you correct me, sometimes different disciplines think of it differently. I'm beginning to think more of at least bedwetting in children is a sleep disorder where they get into really, really, really deep sleep and either lose control or decide, it's just not important enough for me to get up. And so that many things that affect sleep, including big adenoids and tonsils, nasal allergies, how active you are, how well your sleep hygiene is associated with certain things like bedwetting. Does that ring into the way you think about nocturnal bedwetting in children?
Absolutely. It turns out that one of the questions I always ask parents to see whether this is the primary nocturnal enuresis, so you ask them if their kids are kind of like comatose, if they're almost impossible to wake up. Right. And that fits – and actually, when you study these patients in a sleep lab, their problem is that they get into such a deep sleep for so long that the bladder sends this signal saying, I have some urine in it, and the brain is not alert enough to say to inhibit it and say, not now. Mm-hmm. So what happens is, unfortunately, they wet the bed. One of the drugs that's given for sleep is imipramine, which is an antidepressant. But what it actually does is they no longer get into the very, very deep sleep stages, okay? Unfortunately, giving a young kid an antidepressant can also have some other kind of behavior changes.
Right. So the question that the listener called in about bedwetting and tonsils removed is that if we understand it right, removing tonsils, particularly if tonsils are disturbing sleep, may be causing sleep apnea, may otherwise be disturbing sleep, may lead to more bedwetting, particularly by leading to more deeper sleep where decisions are made or loss of control. And it happens, and it's very common with kids who have nocturnal enuresis, which are usually boys much more often than girls. They often won't respond to an alarm put by their head and so forth, one of the questions I'll often ask families. Okay. Now, you mentioned different kinds of incontinence, stress incontinence, urge incontinence. I've got overflow or overactive bladder. You've described how the urine is controlled. Give us an example. You mentioned stress incontinence. How about urge incontinence? Are there reasons for that and how that may occur?
Yeah, I mean, urge incontinence is a correctable cause. For example, it's just a simple urinary infection. People with urinary infections, because the bladder is raw, during the time they have the urinary infection, say that, you know, they actually have had accidents. Another cause can sometimes be, if it's acute, is actually a stone that's at the bladder. Because what happens is that the brain feels the stone being stuck in the wall, and so you feel like you have to pee every 5 or 10 minutes almost uncontrollably. Overflow incontinence is actually almost exclusively that a problem of males. Because what it is that because enlargement of the prostate with age, just kind of like the bathtub that keeps getting off the last amount of volume, they're just getting off the top of the bathtub, and they're not getting the rest of the bathtub. And so actually the treatment for that is very different. For stress incontinence, you want to give more pelvic support. For overflow incontinence, you basically operate or give them drugs to open up the prostate.
Yeah, so the overflow incontinence is an obstruction of the outflow of the bladder is the main reason for that. Is that what you're saying?
Correct.
Okay, and so we need to fix that. And one reason you say it's mainly males is because the main cause of outflow obstruction is hypertrophy or abnormality of that prostate gland that is sitting downstream of the bladder.
Males urinate through the middle of the prostate like urinating through a donut.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What are some treatment options then? Let's give examples of a couple, and what are our options for treatment? And you can take those in any way, form you want.
I mean, it obviously depends upon the cause.
Mm-hmm.
For stress incontinence, the first thing to try is what's called Kegels. Kegels are pelvic floor supports, and they do work somewhat. The problem is, like every exercise program, if you skip it for 3 to 7 days, you're back to where you started from, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The next treatment option for stress incontinence have been some pelvic support procedures, and almost everybody has gone to what's called slings, and normally we put a piece of nylon mesh in there, and the one that's had almost 1 million slings implanted worldwide and about 10 years of experience is called a tension-free vaginal tape. In one form or another. Urge incontinence, which is a problem of capacity, of feeling like you have to go all the time, the first thing, once again, is behavioral modification. The worst time to urinate is when the bladder controls you. You need to control your bladder. So what you do with people with urge incontinence is you ask them to sit down, squeeze the pelvic floor, which inhibits the bladder contraction, wait, let 5 minutes wait so the bladder stretches a little bit more, and then go to the bathroom. If you actually start doing preemptive voiding, what happens is the bladder gets smaller and smaller and smaller. The next step for urge incontinence is sort of dietary changes. Reducing the amount of caffeine will help. Other people notice other kind of foods causing them to have to run to the bathroom. And if that's the case, you simply make those changes in your diet and behavior. And then, of course, you've seen the commercials on TVs that are kind of cute, the gotta go right now commercials with the ladies leaving the conference room. And there's a bunch of pills known as antimuscarinics. In antimuscarinics, there are these receptors in the bladder, not motor, but sensory receptors in the bladder. And so commercial products such as Daytrel, Ditropan, Vesicare have all had ads and direct-to-public consumer ads. And last but not least, at the present time, urologists have tried with some success in selected patients Botox. I always call it mistakenly, you know, getting out the wrinkles, but it's actually not. Botox originally was used for spastic eye muscles, and so you can inject the bladder base for bladder spasticity with Botox.
Which is not a long-term answer.
Semi-long-term.
Mm-hmm.
Think about it this way. Botox paralyzes the muscles for about 6 months. But if I put a cast on your leg in for 6 months and take the cast off, you get so much atrophy in the muscle that actually a good Botox of the bladder will last anywhere when you get a good response for more than 6 months. Usually you expect 1 to 2 years.
So what I was writing down is the stress incontinence, really, there's some surgery. There's not a much in the way of medication. With urge incontinence, there's some lots of options, not really any surgical options other than if, unless we consider the Botox injection. And then we haven't talked about overflow, which we said is mainly obstruction, which I'm assuming has a lot of surgical requirements, but there are some medications as well.
Yeah, I mean, the two drugs that help particularly males urinate are the alpha blockers, which are agents that relax the smooth muscle that's in the prostate. The alpha-1 adrenergic receptors, and so the two drugs that are classically used for that are Flomax, Uroxetrol, and this month they're just about to announce a new drug with a cute name called Rapiflow. And another drug, class of drugs are drugs to shrink the prostate,
okay,
kind of weak testosterone inhibitors. Proscar, finasteride is one, and dutasteride or Avodart is the other one.
Tell me, let's talk about surgical approaches to these. That's what you're a surgeon and urologist, but you do other things. But let's talk about how you go about making the decision of stress incontinence and when you make a decision to need some surgery. What are the kind of thought processes that go through there in a typical patient?
First, the severity. I mean, the patient has to be bothered enough that you can justify even the minimal risks of a TVT with the person's problem. And so if a female, for example, has an occasional accident but she's not even wearing a pad, I would think surgery is premature.
Mm-hmm.
The next thing is that, a good history to make sure that you have the correct diagnosis. Somebody that's had several kids on exam, you ask them to cough and sneeze and they have what's called urethral hypermobility. You can actually, we do a simple test. It's called a Q-tip test. You just take a Q-tip and put some KY jelly, and you get to see the Q-tip deflect like 60 degrees. Mm-hmm. It's a Q-tip test. Mm-hmm. And they don't have any associated problems, and they have clean urine and never have been infected. And that person, is an adequate enough exam and a history to talk to her about the pros and cons of a simple outpatient procedure.
Mm-hmm.
Urge incontinence, that is actually, those people should have failed almost every medication out there before they would consider something like Botox. And in addition, for urge incontinence, you have to worry about things like bladder cancer, which can also cause irritative symptoms. So you want to make sure that you have the correct diagnosis.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
And for overflow incontinence, the problem with Avodart, the nice thing about Flomax is that'll kick in within a week. The problem with Avodart is that takes 6 to 8 weeks to kick in. So a guy who's truly in urinary retention, either he wants to live with a catheter in and out for 6 or 8 weeks, or he decides to have an outpatient procedure. We've been using a green light laser, which is advantage of a green light laser is you don't have the bleeding associated with the old Roto-Rooter or transurethral resection of the prostate that is still done, but at the same time, most of the procedures now are done with the green light laser because of the absence of bleeding and the fact that we can do it as a walk-in, walk-out procedure.
Let me remind our listeners again, if you've got questions about the discussion today with Dr. Tamara on, right now we're talking about incontinence, later we're going to talk about some issues with kidney stones. Let me give you some information on how to get a hold of us. Our local number, 550-8433, 550-8433, and our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And email line1, LINEONE, all one word, at kska.org. It dawns on me, Kevin, that we have not maybe fleshed out the symptoms of particularly overflow incontinence enough. What's the sequence of events that men, since we've identified men in particular, and it's an outflow obstruction, go through or are experiencing? We've talked about, women who may have pelvic floor weakening and leading to the stress incontinence. But what are the men expressing or
noting with this other cat.
It occurs gradually. So they actually, only when you ask them, do they then think about it and notice that their stream is weak. Mm-hmm. They're sitting, classically, they're sitting to have to urinate because the stream is so weak that if they stood, it would end up on their shoes and not in the urinal or the bath or the toilet. They also will tell you that they're urinating anywhere from 5 to 10 times a night, you know, voiding small amounts. Never have a good stream. Other people, for example, who don't have that problem will tell you that when the bladder is full, they have a great stream, and when the bladder is empty, they have a small stream because the size of the stream is proportionate to the volume we have to tank up to get a good stream. So a patient with overflow incontinence never has a good stream, has frequent voidings, particularly worse at night. Because mm-hmm. one of the changes that occurs at night is that our pattern of water production changes. We tend to pull the urine and the water in the daytime, and then as we become recumbent and lay flat, most of the water comes out of our body.
And typically, as a rule, with both of these more common causes, pain is not an issue?
No.
Okay. I just want to make it clear, if we're having a lot of pain or discomfort, then often there's other issues going on.
Usually infection.
Yep. Okay. Let's go ahead and take, we have a couple of callers, and I want to take Justin first. Justin, you're on line one.
Hi there. I wanted to ask if your guest could speculate on the evolution of this bladder control system. In other words, before the development of a social conditioning about the stigma of urination and the sexual organs and so forth, why would it be advantageous for a human ancestor living in the wild to be able to control when they urinate rather than, say, leaking wastes all the time?
Yeah, like if I was an ape in Africa, I'd want to be up quite a bit at night to make sure something's not coming after me. Is that what you're saying?
Or just in general, why is it advantageous to control when we
right.
void and when we don't
okay.
void the bladder,
as
opposed to just a system where it leaks out?
It was all due to that guy who first invented a toilet. I mean, anyway, go ahead, Kevin.
Actually, that's an interesting question. One other difference, next time you're out walking your dog, is that our ATPs are different than a dog's bladder ATPs.
Whoa. What do you mean ATP?
Well, basically, think of the male bladder as being a capacitor. In humans, we have to discharge to zero. So if you ask a human to go and 5 minutes later ask him to go again, he can't.
Uh-huh.
But you take your dog, and your dog every 5 or 10 feet
okay.
is able to do partial discharges. And I think part of it is that they, for example, you have to realize that, yes, we are big predators, but we have to be prepared. We are not, and so, for example, for us to leave a trail of urine would have led other predators to where we lived, okay? So that to be able to store our urine and to be able to put the urine in a place where other larger predators or more mobile predators or more animalistic predators wouldn't know we were around was a survival advantage.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas for your dog, both for mating reasons and also, to mark their territory,
right.
The animals urinate both for scent, territory, and also just eliminate waste.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, interesting. Good question, Justin. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
All right. Karen is on line one. Karen, what can we do for you?
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I have a type of muscular dystrophy that affects the, is it peroneal or perineal? Peroneal nerve. The genetic disease in my family, it doesn't kick in until you're about 45. And so that was about 6 years ago. And what I've noticed is sensory, like with cold air hitting my legs, I'll lose urine, and I was wondering if you had any suggestions as to medications that might be more appropriate for my problem.
Well, I think, first of all, rather than try pills, I mean, staying warm and not getting the trigger of the cold air or the wetness, is probably the best thing to do. I mean, the problem that comes up with is that medications that will cause you to desensitate will be on board whether you're inside the house or outside when you get the events that trigger you to have these urinary accidents. Having said that, you will improve your form of control by giving you some of the anti-muscarinics. But I have a question for you. Do you ever have trouble with when you cough or sneeze with leakage or not?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Then one of the drugs that you may talk to your physician about is a drug called Cymbalta. Cymbalta is an antidepressant, but it actually also has what's known as some norepinephrine effects. And Cymbalta actually did some clinical trials for stress urinary incontinence, and it actually turned out that it helped the bladder store, and it also helped the external urethra to hold better. But because of the antidepressant side effects, it did not get approved for that urinary leakage or mixed incontinence picture, but we as urologists use it off-label.
Cool.
So, go ahead. Sorry, Karen, go ahead.
I appreciate knowing that, and yeah, I can tell you the best knee socks in the whole world. They're soccer socks. Believe me, I use every trick in the book. Something I have learned, too, that you might like to know for your patients, you know how when you're getting closer to the toilet, it seems like you really got to go. So if you can imagine with your lips that you're sucking on a straw, mm-hmm. that seems to help. I don't know, something down there so that maybe the urine won't cut loose.
Yeah, I guess it's almost like doing Kegel. I don't know exactly what Kegel exercises are for sure, but that's my impression of what they are. Is that right?
I think what she's doing is doing a Kegel.
Right.
And the way she can visualize it is sucking a straw.
You're tightening that external sphincter and controlling things a little bit better with that thought process, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, and then the other thing, you used a term I read a lot, and androgenic. Yeah. And you used it a little while ago. It has to do, I believe, maybe with the adrenals triggering a nerve or something. Androgenic.
Yeah, I don't remember. Kevin's frowning too. We don't remember that comment off the top of our head, Karen.
Okay.
Androgenic usually has.
Maybe you were discussing one of the meds.
Yeah. Yeah. Androgenic refers to a male.
Hormone
or male constitution kind of thing as opposed
androgen.
To a feminine, and the androgen. Yeah.
Okay.
And so side effects of some medications may have side effects that are more masculine in their output.
Oh, yeah. Okay, that wouldn't be good.
Nope.
Any other suggestions for me?
Well, I would like to always make a comment about the medications, and I think this is a common misconception. I'm always working towards stopping or helping people understand more, and that's what Kevin said about using a medication off-label. The FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, is responsible for regulating pharmaceutical companies and how they can sell and market their products and what they must do to prove that they're safe and effective to even sell them. They do not regulate the use of medications by physicians, although there's becoming more and more of a perhaps gray area in that as they sometimes scare consumers by what they say. So the use of a product off-label means that a physician is using a product in a way that has not been shown to be safe and effective to the FDA. That doesn't mean it's unethical or illegal or even incorrect. And in particularly in pediatrics, there's a lot of medications that we use that are not ever been studied in kids, and doesn't mean that they're ineffective. So his use of the word off-label is not inappropriate, or doesn't mean anything bad to those who are listening.
Right, like you have serotonin receptors in places other than just in the brain.
That's true, too.
So a serotonin medication might apply to different parts of the body.
I think any time you take anything orally in particular, you're probably going to have multiple effects, but not just the primary effect that the drug may
be.
Good
and bad.
Yep, that's true. Although the treatments, the medications are getting better and better and better at controlling those kinds of things, I'd have to say also.
And then if a person wanted to make an appointment with Dr. Tamara, about how far out should a person call?
Tell us how to get in touch with you, Kevin.
Oh, that's easy. 276-8529.
Okay.
And usually, depending upon the severity of the problem, it's anywhere from the same day for somebody who's in pain to 2-3 days.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Yep, good luck, Karen.
Thanks.
Anything else we need to say about incontinence? Our time's moving along, and I want to make sure we talk about kidney stones. Any other issues?
No.
Okay. All right, well, let's move on. Those of you who are listening, 550-8433, if you want to give us a call, let's talk about kidney stones. Let's start by the definition again. What do you mean by kidney stone?
Kidney stones, unfortunately, are usually inorganic, but basically material that conglomerates within the kidneys and ureters that causes blockage or obstruction. And when I say both organic and inorganic, sometimes you can form stones from amino acids, which are natural building products. But most of the time, the most common kidney stone is calcium oxalate, and they're basically rocks. You can actually hit it with a hammer, and it looks like a small little brown black rock.
And they form up in the kidney, and from the kidney they pursue, go down the ureters into the bladder, as you said. And my understanding, and fortunately I don't know, that causes some discomfort. You usually know when that's happened.
Most people would use a stronger term than discomfort. Unfortunately, kidney stones are among the most painful conditions that are out there. And the reason being is that you have our normal tubes are about 2 millimeters in size, and a normal stone is about 5 millimeters in size, and you're trying to take a 2-millimeter tube and stretch it to 5 millimeters in size in 5 minutes. And the body lets you know that that is not going to happen.
So it's this, the opening or the dilation of the ureter that causes most of the discomfort. It's not the irritation of this rock, as you put it, kind of coming down your ureter, or is it a combination of that?
No, it's mostly the stretching.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what's the risk factors for kidney stones?
Fluid.
Okay.
It actually turns out that 97% of kidney stones can be prevented if you can get the person to make more than 2 liters of urine a day. Unfortunately, up here in Alaska, where it's very dry, between the urine production, between the dry air and our evaporative loss from our lungs, a little bit of sweat, and our loss in our colon, is you have to drink over 5 liters of fluid to make 2 liters of urine.
And so drinking more water makes us make more urine, which dilutes those minerals that have to be excreted normally in our urine, and therefore they're not as likely to cause a stone. Is that an oversimplification?
No, it is the...
That's it.
That is it for 97% of people. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are some people who have an endocrine disorder, for example, hyperparathyroidism. And there are other people who have inherited metabolic disorder, such as cystinosis or cystine stones. But for the most part, you know, over 95% of the stones that form are called idiopathic. And the most common cause for idiopathic stones is just inadequate urine volume, which means inadequate fluid intake. Paradoxically, one of the things I always like to tell people is to ignore what their friends tell them. Their friends will often tell them that they have too much calcium in their diet, but actually most of the people who follow that advice will form more stones than people who ignore that advice. Actually, the average American's diet is very low in calcium and paradoxically tends to increase our risk for stone formation. So the number one way to prevent stones is to drink.
Let's talk about the calcium metabolism thing, and where does the calcium come from that ends up in our bloodstream that gets into our urine in the first place?
Even if you totally eliminated the calcium in your diet, our bones are a big reservoir of calcium, and we're always leaching a lot of calcium out of our bones over a 24-hour period. And so to explain why people who restrict calcium in their diet form more stones, here's the reason why. As you take some calcium, there's also oxalate in our diet, and there's also fats. And some of the calcium binds to the fats and comes out in the stool. That leaves the oxalate unbound. And what happens is that the oxalate then gets absorbed, and oxalate's high in things like iced tea, for example, is high in oxalates. Chocolates are high in oxalate. And the oxalates then get absorbed and get excreted through the kidneys. And since you always have some minerals coming out of the bone, the calcium, you will form calcium stones, paradoxically, because you have too much absorption that's no longer opposed by calcium in your diet. A big cause of hyperoxaluria, to give you an example, is the recent fat operations. The gastric bypass, for example, those patients, because of their abnormal GI tract now, actually are at higher risk for stone formation, and they actually need to take calcium supplements to offset what's called a hyperoxaluria. Okay. And so it's your body always needs to be in balance, but also your diet is part of that balance. And so you need to have a certain amount of calcium in your diet, not only for good bone metabolism, but also to prevent kidney stones.
Okay. Remind our listeners again, if you have questions or comments about kidney stones, which we're talking about now with Dr. Kevin Tamara, 550-8433 is our local number, 550-8433. And a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And you can reach us by email until just before 3 o'clock today at line 1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org. Other interesting things about kidney stones, as we kind of talked about before we went on the air, is that astronauts have a big problem with that, and people that are relatively sedentary, who may have disorders, neurologic disorders, or where they may not move around much, have some increased risk. And why would that be?
Well, astronauts, for example, when they become weightless, when you no longer have the weight bearing on the bones sense that they don't need to be as strong. And when that happens, all of a sudden they start to leach out a lot of calcium. So weight-bearing activity helps strengthen your bones. Of course, the astronauts don't have artificial gravity at the present time, but even within a 72-hour mission, they will form a kidney stone. Mm. And that's been a problem for NASA. Earlier, we also were talking that this has been a problem for the U.S. military. Because of the sweating, the 100-pound packs and the flak jackets in Iraq, it actually turns out that over half of all the medevacs have been done for kidney stones in these young guys over in Iraq who just don't get enough water and don't get enough urine production.
And it's a, as you mentioned earlier also, it's a fairly common reason to go to the emergency room, which kind of surprised me, and particularly more so up here than in other parts of the country.
Oh, yeah, kidney stones are among the top 10 reasons why people go to the ER. Mm-hmm. And the pain is excruciating. And for one thing, these people are previously healthy, and all of a sudden they get hit with a severe flank pain, and they don't have any idea what's going on.
By flank pain, you mean?
Pain in your side.
Okay.
And usually associated with nausea. You can even vomit. And unlike appendicitis where you don't want to move around, the pain is colicky. You really can't find a comfortable position, so you're just moving, writhing around in pain. Mm-hmm. And up here, the reason why we don't sweat, but people forget how dry it is, how the lack of humidity. And so people forget that we're basically flying on an airplane all the time, you know, because mm-hmm. of the lack of humidity. Mm-hmm. And so we don't drink enough, and we get very concentrated urine. And also we have a habit of drinking, let's say, coffee, and people think coffee is fluid, and it kind of is, but coffee is also a weak diuretic. So you actually end up in a negative deficit. And so it's important that at least half of what you drink is water and half can be, you know, the other things. There's also a higher incidence of stone in people who drink carbonated beverages. So somebody who drinks nothing but Diet Cokes is also placing himself at risk for kidney stones.
And how is the diagnosis made? You've come into the emergency room, you got this side pain, it's excruciating, it's colicky, which means it kind of comes and goes and builds up and then gets better. How's the diagnosis made?
I mean, first is just the urine, because 97% of people will have blood in their urine.
Because of the irritation of that stone.
Yeah, they are not ball bearings. They're these rough, jagged things, nasty things. They look like a piece of the moon.
Okay.
And they feel like a piece of the moon. And the actually, paradoxically, one of the things is sometimes the treatment gives you the diagnosis. Classically, now there's a new drug, or a fairly new drug, called Toradol, Ketorolac. It's not a narcotic, but it actually helps relax the spasm. It's basically an IM form of aspirin, mm-hmm. and doesn't do much, for example, if somebody has appendicitis, but does wonderful for kidney and ureteral stone. Mm-hmm. And then last but not least, you know, an X-ray image will prove it. We kind of come full circle. We used to do plain X-rays and an old test called an IVP, but that would sometimes take several hours because of blockage. So then we moved to CT scans or CT stone studies, and they're great. The only problem with a CT stone study, though, is a CT stone study is approximately equivalent to 300 to 500 chest films. So the radiation dose of a CT stone study is actually quite a lot. And as a result of that, people have reconsidered whether or not they need to do all these CT stone studies. And recently, we have started adopting, we earlier referred to a drug called Flomax and Uroxetrol, drugs that we give to old males to help them urinate better. But we found out that it helps both males and females urinate out their stones. It shortens the time to stone passage and allows you to pass bigger stones, okay? And so, for example, if females are willing to put up with pain, they can pass stones as large as 8 millimeters. They did this in Turkey within a month by taking Flomax with a 95% chance. They moved from 47% spontaneous passage to 95%. The reason why the success rate was so low was because of the size of the stones. Using the U.S., we use a cutoff of 5 millimeters, but over there they used 8 millimeters. And that's a third of an inch. A third of an inch is a huge rock. And I'm not sure I would want to be miserable for a month, but it turns out that you can you won't do any permanent damage if you tough it out for a month. And if you put Flomax in a female, you'll have a 95% guarantee they'll pass their stones. So nowadays, we've only moved to CT scans when we're uncertain about the diagnosis or if we're about to choose the form of intervention. So now it's kind of the history, the response to Toradol and a KUB in a urine.
We have a couple of questions. One was sent in by email. A woman says that her son had a stone at age 23. He didn't smoke. He didn't drink. Seemed like he was in very, very good health. But someone had suggested to her that the physicians may see more kidney stones in young men because of the current vogue of drinking Red Bull. Red Bull, she mentions, has a high concentration of caffeine and carbonation. Does that make sense to you? Is that an experience you've noticed, or do you know anything more about that?
Well, caffeine is a diuretic, and if he's drinking Red Bull and he's not drinking other things, yes, it's going to place him at greater risk.
So a diuretic is causing you to urinate more. Caffeine can do that, and if you're not replacing that extra water loss, you're, in a sense, becoming more dehydrated with time. You're not keeping up with your needs.
Absolutely.
Okay, so that may make sense. You've not heard specifically that these Red Bull-like drinks are a greater risk or not, or have you?
No,
okay.
Not.
All right, let's take a call. We've got Jim on line one. Jim, what can we do for you?
Yes, you were trying to determine what the level of pain was in passing kidney stones. I passed kidney stones when I was in my late 20s, and I was drinking a lot of carbonated beverages also, but the thing that visualized came to my mind while I was in this process was a blowfish. I had a blowfish inside of my bladder trying to get out. And if you can visualize what that would feel like, that's what past the kidney stone is equated to.
Yeah. And you're not thinking about just the size. You're thinking about those spines on the outside of that blowfish.
Well, the size and the pain that would cause. You know, it's just I just had that visualization
right.
While I was going.
Oh, okay.
While that process. So just a little help to, associate that with the pain.
So you're saying it's not pleasant.
Absolutely not.
Okey-dokey.
It was a total surprise also.
And you haven't had any more?
No, I never have. I'm definitely into drinking a lot more fluids. I drink a lot of herbal teas and a lot more water. I wasn't aware of the ratio of the amount of water you have to drink to produce the amount of urine necessary, but... So anyway, that was some good information.
Okay. Thanks very much for your call.
Thank you.
Well, one of the thoughts that came to my mind is if most kidney stones are 2 millimeters or larger, how do we know we're not passing smaller stones all the time?
Obviously, we're always passing some minerals. And at what point do you have minerals and at what point are the crystals become sort of a clinical stone?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's kind of an academic exercise.
Mm-hmm.
You have to realize that somewhere about 1 millimeter more in size is when obviously you start to get this discomfort or sense of perception of pain or stretch when you dilate the stones. And in addition, the stones form in the calyx. And the calyx are these little dependent structures. And so they have to have a certain sort of mass to actually get propelled out of the dependent calyx.
The calyx is part of the kidney that's the collecting area, the larger collecting tubes within the kidney itself that
Correct.
Leads to the ureter.
The side branches, the
right.
tributaries.
Yeah. Okay. All right. All right. Yeah, that was kind of a medical question. I know sometimes there's been the theory that when you have a little bit of blood in your urine, you can't find any other reason that maybe there is gravel or sand, microscopic. I've never been too much of a fan of that idea, but it just went into my mind for microscopic hematuria as being caused by subclinical stones.
No, because they have to be large enough to scratch.
Okay.
And to be large enough to scratch, okay. they have to be about 2 or 3 millimeters in size.
Okay. Let's talk some more about treatment. You've mentioned a couple of treatments and some prevention. There's an office right next to mine that does something with ultrasound and makes lots of noise that's treating stones, I understand, nowadays, too. How do you decide about that? When's it indicated? And what am I talking about?
Okay. I'd like to separate kidney stones into medical stone disease and surgical stone disease. Surgical okay. stone disease is large stones, too big to pass, stones that are causing pain, stones that are causing infection or blockage or problems. And so some of it is based upon location of the stone. If a stone is in the pelvis, those are close enough to the bladder that we just put a scope or a basket and just remove them if they need to be. I mean, the first thing to do is what's called medical expulsive therapy for stones. In medicine, we always like acronyms. And so medical expulsive therapy for stones is often abbreviated in the charts as METS, M-E-T-S, which is good or bad because METS sometimes stands for metastatic cancer. But we're not talking cancer here. We're talking stones. And so medical expulsive therapy for stones has changed the way we treat most stones because most stones will pass and they'll pass better and easier if people are on alpha blockers, Flomax and Uroxetrol, and they're very well tolerated as well as with the narcotics. Stones that are up in the kidney, usually we do what's called the stone machine. The stone machine makes it takes advantage of the fact that we're jello. We're 95% water. We shake. So when a supersonic shockwave hits a crystalline structure, it breaks it. And so what we do is on the stone machine, which is called the ESWL for short, extracorporeal shockwave lithotripsure, there's a little spark plug that causes a little vaporization of water, a little gas bubble, super pressurized mechanical shockwave comes out. We focus it and target on the stone and hit the stone 2,000 to 3,000 pulses to break it up into silt, to break mm-hmm. it up into small stuff so it passes. Now, stones that are in the ureter are kind of interesting. Because 10 years ago, the recommendation was for upper ureteral stones to do the stone bath. We now have smaller scopes. We have these little holmium lasers that can contact stones. And what's happened is two things. We've gotten better with the small instruments, although I will tell you that putting a scope up the urethra in a male, putting it up the ureter, the little tube, they all know we've been there. And so they're miserable afterwards with stents. Mm-hmm. However, it turns out that the first generation of stone machines, the spark plug stone machines, were very, very effective, 90%+. And we went down a wrong pathway. People started to go to what I call the woofers, the electromagnetic, almost like a subwoofer machines. And the success rate started dropping to 70%. So our last recent guidelines from the American Urological Association was that actually that ureteroscopy is now equivalent to the stone machine, but they actually what they should have done is they should have said that the spark plug technology is better than ureteroscopy, and the electromagnetic technology or the woofer technology is actually it doesn't get as good a fragmentation rate as the old spark plugs do, and so the machines are now evolving now that we understand the technology better. A more appropriate focus, actually less pressure, so they actually crack stones better. So that the spark plug technology is, we are coming full circle and starting to go back to the technology that was originally in the 1980s, mm-hmm. our latest version of it, though.
So let me make sure I heard you right. So the lithotripsy is becoming back into vogue for some of those ureteral stones because the technology is better and the outcomes are good and safer. Is that
depending upon what the shockwave generator is.
Okay.
We're going from...
What machine you have.
Yes.
Okay. All right. All right. What are complications of the lithotripsy? What are the downsides?
The original machine, you say, well, why aren't people using the original Dornier HM3, human model 3 machine, which is the old bathtub of water? And the problem with that one, it had great first kill. I mean, it really broke up stones well. And it had such a big focal size that you didn't need even fluoro. You just needed to make sure you're on the right side of the patient. The bad news, there was an article published by Dr. Segura, who now has passed away at the Mayo Clinic, and he showed at 5 years that those patients had a higher incidence of diabetes and a higher incidence of hypertension as opposed to people with medical treatment of their kidney stones or other forms of surgical treatment. Mm-hmm. And it occurred obviously on the left side because the pancreas got hit. But even on the right side, the pancreas got hit by the big non-focused shockwave of the HM3. The newer stone machines have a much smaller focus. The problem with the electromagnetic ones is that their focus became too small and too high pressure. And so now we've learned that, you know, like everything else, you can overdo things. And so the newer spark plug technologies seem to cause the least amount of tissue damage, and they have not, when looked at, seem to have had the associated risk of hypertension and diabetes. But there is still that potential, and that study that was done by Dr. Segura is a very solid study. Another risk of the procedure is simply the risk that you crack the stone and the fragments get caught. And so one of the reasons why you don't just hit the stone 100 pulses is you want to make sure that everything is just like sand or silt so you don't have any trouble passing the fragments. Another problem, and there are some stones that are either the patient is too big because there's a limit to the how deep we can go with the stone machines, or the stones are too hard. And so, of course, a medium-sized stone can be kind of large, but if you have a hard stone, it can be small. But if you have a big hard stone, then there's other forms of intervention that should be done, including percutaneous, where one makes a little band-aid incision, puts a scope directly into the kidney, and puts a probe directly on the stone, and as you break it up, you suck out the stone. Because if you have a 1-centimeter stone, that's 100 cubic millimeters. But if you have a 2-centimeter stone, we're talking 800 cubic millimeters of stone and a lot more fragments. And those fragments will – the Germans were the ones who developed the machine. They also developed a word for that problem when you have 4 inches of stone material caught in the ureter. And they call it a Steinstraße, a road of gravel. And as it sounds, it's not very nice to have.
All right. We've really got just only about 30 seconds. I want to try to get this last email. There's a message about someone who had some mesh being used for bladder support, and it may have eroded into other tissues, causing pain when it was used for bladder lifts. Is that a common problem, or do you have any comments about it?
It probably wasn't the mesh. It was the mesh gets infected. That can be a problem. And there have been FDA warnings about the surgeons to be appropriate with the use of mesh.
Kiddo. Well, thanks very much. This has been another very enjoyable and educational hour for me. I appreciate you taking the time to be with us.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thanks to today's guest, Kevin Tamara. Next week, we're going to be talking about radiation therapy. To my recollection, in the 10 years I've been doing this, this is the first time we've talked about radiation therapy, and we're going to talk about that with Anchorage radiation oncologist Dr. Barrett Madsen. So tune into your health and learn more on Monday, March 16th at 2 p.m., repeating the same evening at 8 p.m. on FM 91.1. For KSKA and for Line 1, this is Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
This has been Line 1, your health connection. If you have questions or comments concerning this program, write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508, or email us at line1@ksKA.org. Additional information on today's show topic, including relevant website links, will be posted along with audio of today's program on our website at ksKA.org/line1. CD copies of this program can be purchased by calling 550-8400 during regular business hours. This is KSKA, Anchorage.